The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service. And for the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine will come first from the March 24, 2025 edition, the cover of which is bordered in red, as usual, with a white narrow inner border. Time is in gray, capital block lettering, large, superimposed upon a dark background, from gradated from blue to gray to black. There's a horse rearing in the background and in the front, a man dressed in white, Lewis Hamilton. Proceeding to the inside, then, there will be a feature item of the world's greatest places, from which I will select samples to read. This is, of course, according to Time, the world's greatest places. But first, the view, technology, a Cold War model for AI by Dan Hendricks and Eric Schmidt. The unveiling of DeepSeek R1, China's most advanced AI model to date, signals a dangerous inflection point in the global AI race. As President Donald Trump warned in response, this development represents a wake-up call for American leadership. What is at stake is not merely economic competitiveness, but also the most geopolitically precarious technology since the nuclear age. After the creation of the atomic bomb, America's technological monopoly lasted only 4 years before Soviet scientists achieved parity. This balance of terror, combined with the unprecedented destructive potential of these new weapons, gave rise to a mutual assured destruction, MAD, a deterrence framework that, despite its flaws, prevented catastrophic conflict for decades. Today's AI competition has the potential to be even more complex, in part because AI touches nearly everything from medicine to finance to defense. Powerful AI may even automate AI research itself. Recursively improving AI enhances its abilities without prompting from humans. A nation on the cusp of wielding superintelligent AI, an AI vastly smarter than humans in virtually every domain, would amount to a national security emergency for its rivals, who might turn to threatening sabotage rather than cede power. If we're heading toward a world with superintelligence, we must be clear-eyed about the potential for geopolitical instability. Let us imagine how the U.S. might reasonably respond to rival states seeking an insurmountable AI advantage. Suppose Beijing established a lead over American AI labs and reached the cusp of recursively improving superintelligence before us. Regardless of whether Beijing could maintain control over what it was building, U.S. national security would be existentially threatened. Rationally, we may resort to threatening sabotage in the form of cyber attacks against AI data centers in China. We might similarly expect Xi Jinping or Vladimir Putin, who has little chance of obtaining the technology first, to respond in a similar fashion if we approach recursively improving superintelligence. They would not stand idly by if a U.S. monopoly on power were imminent. Just as the destabilizing pursuit of nuclear monopoly eventually gave way to the stability of MAD, we may soon enter a parallel deterrence regime for AI. If any state that attempts to seize AI supremacy can expect the threat of preemptive sabotage, states may be deterred from pursuing unilateral power altogether. We call this outcome mutual assured AI malfunction, MAME. MAME is a deterrence framework designed to maintain strategic advantage, prevent escalation, and restrict the ambitions of rivals and malicious actors. For it to work, the U.S. must make clear that any rival destabilizing AI project, especially one aiming for superintelligence, will provoke retaliation. While building this deterrence framework, America must simultaneously advance on two additional fronts: AI non-proliferation and domestic competitiveness. For non-proliferation, we should enact stronger AI chip export controls and monitoring to stop computing power from getting into the hands of dangerous people. We should treat AI chips more like uranium, keeping tight records of product movements, building in limitations on what high-end AI chips are authorized to do, and granting federal agencies the authority to track and shut down illicit distribution routes. Finally, to maintain a competitive edge, the U.S. should focus on building resilience in its supply chains for military tech and computing power. In particular, our reliance on Taiwan for AI chips is a glaring vulnerability and a critical choke point. While the West has a decisive AI chip advantage, Chinese disruption could reverse that. The U.S. should step up its own domestic chip design and manufacturing capabilities. Superintelligent AI poses a challenge as elusive as any that policymakers have faced. It is what theorists Horst Rittel and Melvin Weber called a wicked problem, one that continually evolves with no final formula for resolution. MAME, supplemented by robust non-proliferation and renewed investment in American industry, offers a strategy grounded in the lessons of past arms races. There is no purely technical fix that can tame these forces, but the right combination of deterrence, non-proliferation, and competitiveness measures can help the U.S. navigate the emerging geopolitical reality of superintelligence. The authors Dan Hendricks and Eric Schmidt are listed as being director of the Center for AI Safety. Referring to Hendricks, and Schmidt is the former CEO of Google. Next to the world's greatest places, based upon Time's estimation, I'll read several of these just randomly. There are pages and pages of them. The world's greatest places, Flagstaff, Arizona, the Lowell Observatory, written in the stars. This is written by Nicholas DiRenzo. Astronomer Percival Lowell founded his Arizona stargazing lab in 1894 to aid in his search for life on Mars. While that quest is still ongoing, the observatory made history as the place where assistant Clyde Tombaugh discovered Pluto in 1930. If you're still not over its dwarf planet Demotion, be sure to visit during the annual I Heart Pluto Festival, which started in 2020. Last fall, the observatory expanded to welcome visitors in the new $53 million Marley Foundation Astronomy Discovery Center, where the central atrium is dominated by a suspended installation symbolizing the evolution of matter after the Big Bang. Other exhibits are much more down to earth, prioritizing all ages interactivity. Families can catch a show on the two-story, 160-degree wraparound LED theater screen, while kids can smell moon dust, send messages into space, and launch their own rockets. Executive Director Amanda Bosch first came to the observatory as an MIT postdoctoral fellow, and she's made spreading the celestial word a core part of her mission, including by co-founding the Native American Astronomy Outreach Program. When I first visited Lowell Observatory in 1985, I was spellbound by the beautiful telescopes and the important discoveries, she says. I'm so happy that I get to share these discoveries with the next generations. The most game-changing feature of the expansion is its rooftop planetarium, befitting Flagstaff's position as the first international dark sky place. The planetarium skips a domed movie screen in favor of the wide open night sky. Heated seats let you take in celestial sights even when it's snowing. Lowell staff will point out planets, stars, constellations, whatever visitors like comets and meteor showers are in the sky on a given night, says Bosch. Unlike at a normal planetarium with a programmed show, that unpredictability is a pivotal part of the experience. One night, the International Space Station may pass overhead. Another might bring the Lyrid meteor showers. Astrotourism has gained traction around the globe in recent years, helped along by 2024's astounding solar eclipse, as travelers look for more peaceful and meaningful escapes. Destinations everywhere, from the Atacama Desert to Namibia, have leaned into their nocturnal bona fides. Glamping bubbles and retractable roof safari tents that allow for in-bed stargazing have grown in popularity with newcomers in the, so to speak, space, including Clear Sky Resorts in Utah, Cosmos Stargazing Resort and Spa in Colorado, and Acacia Kokoko Camp in Tanzania's Ruaha National Park. Hotels and resorts are investing in staff astronomers, building their own private observatories, and planning group outings to see phenomena like the Perseid meteor shower. Arizona has become an unofficial capital of astrotourism, with 20 dark sky certified communities, parks, sanctuaries, and urban spaces stretching across all corners of the Grand Canyon State. This January, for instance, Tucson even introduced its own Astro Trail, which links up state and national parks, observatories, a planetarium, an air and space museum, and the Richard F. Karras Mirror Lab, where nearly 28-foot-wide mirrors are the world's most advanced telescopes, are created beneath the University of Arizona football stadium. Near the Lowell Observatory in Flagstaff, other Dark Sky International designated locations include Sunset Crater Volcano, Walnut Canyon, Wupatki National Monuments, where light pollution is effectively non-existent. Flagstaff sits squarely on Route 66, which celebrates its centennial in 2026. And because of the city's dark sky protections, visitors can often see the Milky Way right from the center of town. Guests at local hotels can even stargaze without leaving the property. High Country Motor Lodge hosts Lowell astronomers for after-dark star parties, while the retro Americana Motor Hotel off Route 66 lends out telescopes to guests. But none has the scientific legitimacy of the Lowell Observatory, which takes astrotourism to a whole new level. With earthly extravagances like elaborate spa treatments and expansive suites, feeling increasingly commonplace, the ultimate luxury just might be something much simpler, a dark slice of sky where you can look up, take a deep breath, and contemplate the vastness of the universe. Stockholm, Archipelago Trail, connecting the Swedish Isles. The Stockholm Archipelago stretches into the Baltic Sea, about 50 miles east of the Swedish capital. A new 168-mile trail, which opened in November, snakes through some of the most remote corners of the coastal area, connecting 20 islands, with help from ferries and private boat taxis, where birch and juniper forests give way to granite cliffs. For multi-day excursions, hikers can stay anywhere from campsites to spa hotels. B&Bs and unique lodgings like an old pilot lookout tower on Landsort. That was by Julia Denisiuk. Turning the page to Nuuk, spelled N-U-U-K, Greenland, H-X Grand Greenland, the newly accessible Arctic, by Bailey Berg. Reaching the northernmost parts of Greenland is tricky. Limited transportation has long made it one of the most isolated places on Earth. That's changing after the November opening of Nuuk International Airport. With the improved connectivity, HX is partnering with Air Greenland to launch three new Green Greenland cruises from Nuuk. The voyages, Icy Giants of Disco Bay, Mythical Lands of the North, and Farthest North to Thule and Kane Basin, will sail farther north than the cruise line has gone before, up the little-visited western coast, offering the chance to see dramatic landscapes like the electric blue glaciers of the Ilulissat ice fjord and spot walruses, narwhals, polar bears. With sustainability a top priority, Greenland saw a 74% jump in cruise passengers from 2022 to 2023. Each cruise will be on board the MS Fridtjof Nansen, a hybrid battery-powered ship with a maximum capacity of 530. Lindsay Lambert writes about the British Virgin Islands, a luxury comeback Peter Island resort. In 2017, Hurricanes Irma and Maria pummeled Peter Island, leaving a trail of devastation and shuttering family-owned Peter Island Resort for the next 7 years. David Van Andel, who grew up on the isle and is president of the resort, recalls crying upon surveying the damage to the property, which for more than four decades has employed generations of BVI families and been a mainstay of Caribbean luxury travel. In December, the resort finally reopened, complete with a yacht club and an oceanfront spa. And on this page, finally, Wakayama, Japan. Kumano Nachi Taisha Shrine and Seigano Toji Temple, A Tranquil Escape by Adam H. Graham. An hour from crowded Kyoto, the Kumano Kodo pilgrimage trails are serene, almost spiritual. The most mystical of all is the sacred 436-foot Nachi waterfall, Japan's longest, in the Nachi Forest, which is home to 48 other waterfalls and sacred grounds for practitioners of Yamabushi, a form of ascetic mountain worship. The waterfall's Kumano Nachi Taisha Shrine and Seiga Toji Temple reopened in December after a refurb and a fresh coat of vermilion paint, the first since its 1972 reconstruction. Jaipur, India, Raffles Jaipur by Poonam Binayak. Rajasthani grandeur, Jaipur, the flamboyant capital of the Indian state of Rajasthan, is no stranger to grand hotels, but Raffles Jaipur, opened in July, is in a class of its own. Inspired by a Zenana Queen's Palace, the hotel is a design masterpiece with swirls of hand-carved marble, Mughal-style arches, perforated latticework screens called jalis and thikri art, a traditional glass and mirror mosaic unique to the region. Guests can shadow local craftspeople and get exclusive tours of the new Jaipur Center for Art housed in the city palace. Detroit Lakes, Minnesota. Alexa's Elixir, Trash to Treasure Hunt by Ashley Halpern. More than 300 volunteers helped Danish artist Thomas Dombo realize Alexa's Elixir. The exhibition opened last summer features five giant trolls, the 42-foot-high long leaf is the tallest ever, a golden rabbit, three magic portals, and some 800 birdhouses scattered around the Detroit Lakes region, all made from scrap wood and recycled materials. A website helps visitors find the sculptures, some deep in the woods, and geotag them for others to discover. Nintendo Museum in Uji, UJI, Japan, Playing with Power by Jessica Shaw. You do not need to know a Mario from a Zelda to appreciate the Nintendo Museum, but anyone who spent their childhood or last weekend glued to their Game Boy or Switch may find themselves transported. The two-story museum opened in October in Uji, about 30 minutes south of Kyoto, on the site of the company's former Uji Ogura plant, where the Hanafuda trading cards that first put the company on Japan's map were once printed. Much of the museum is devoted to artifacts from gaming giants' 135-year history. Who knew it once made a stroller? On the interactive floor, visitors can team up to operate an oversized Wii remote or play a version of 1968's Ultra Machine SP, which involves using a padded bat to hit balls around a room filled with era-appropriate furniture. Post-gaming snacks are available at Hatena Burger, which offers so many bun and topping options it claims 270,000 different combos are possible. Palm Beach, Florida, Palm House, Modern Glam by Adam Robb. The Mar-a-Lago Club in Palm Beach may be known as the Winter White House, but it is not the only landmark on this Tony, South Florida island. Palm House, is one of the first contemporary luxury hotels to open among more historic hubs of exclusivity. Locals have a soft spot for Palm House in particular because it once served as the island's last dive bar. After a five-year renovation, guests will now find slim errands, photos decorating hallways that lead to a secluded pool deck, complete with shell pink sun umbrellas, where cabana attendants eagerly mist Evian and wipe smudged sunglasses. An even more sequestered two-story presidential suite is outfitted with an immense Alaskan king bed. The heart of the hotel, however, is the dining room, an all-day Nobu-inspired restaurant where the acclaimed sushi chef serves his signature miso cod in tones of blonde and coral that complement the dining room's well-coiffed regulars. Oslo, Trosten, A Floating Sauna for All, by Kathleen Relihan. A sustainably built, universally accessible floating sauna opened in the Norwegian capital last May. Fashioned from recycled aluminum scrap and terrazzo tiles, Trosten's design accommodates wheelchair users and others with mobility impairments, something overlooked in many wellness spaces. The sauna sits in front of another architectural marvel, the Aluminum Munch Museum. Even when the fjord's covered in ice, saunagoers cool off with year-round plunges in the Oslo harbor. Turning the page, I have to move more quickly now. Denver, Populous, A Greener Hotel, by Annalisa Sorensen. The striking Populous, opened in November, aims to be the nation's first carbon-positive hotel. There's no parking garage to encourage walking and taking public transit. The windows have lids for shade. An on-site biodigester composts 100% of food waste, and the hotel uses reclaimed materials throughout. The earthy rooms are showered in natural light with pressed wildflower artwork and hammock seating. Any emissions are monitored by an outside firm and offset by continual tree plantings with the U.S. Forest Service. Paris, Notre Dame. Like a Phoenix, by Richard Morgan. When fire ravaged Notre Dame in 2019, proposals for rebuilding the 12th century cathedral included a rooftop pool and a glass spire. But when it reopened in December, it stood as a marvel of authenticity. The $737 million restoration made the French icon into a global one, as artisans worldwide contributed centuries-old techniques to the craft work. Public display has resumed for the crown of thorns, purportedly worn by Jesus at his crucifixion, and the reopening is expected to attract up to 15 million visitors through 2025. Sloatsburg, New York, The Ranch, Hudson Valley. A Wellness Legend, Heads East, by Deborah Levtov. When Malibu's celeb-loved wellness cum boot camp retreat, The Ranch, launched a second location last year on a stunning lakefront estate 45 minutes north of Manhattan, the famously intense hiking regimen was adjusted for New Yorkers' busy lifestyles. Here, guests choose from shorter 3 or 4 night programs, which still include guided daily hikes, strength training, yoga, meditation, massages, and sound baths. Organic plant-focused meals are served communally in an elegant dining room overlooking the lake. Time Off, Hollywood Follies by Judy Berman. If it was up to me, an idealistic Hollywood executive played by Seth Rogen assures his assistant in the series premiere of The Studio, we'd be focusing on making the next Rosemary's Baby or Annie Hall or, you know, some great film that was not directed by a F-space C-K-I-N pervert. Then suddenly it is up to him. Upon arriving at the offices of his employer, the fictional Continental Studios, Rogan's Matt Remick learns his boss has just been fired. The studio's mercurial CEO, Bryan Cranston, offers him the job, but only if he agrees to make a Kool-Aid movie. Matt does not hesitate before replying in the wall-smashing affirmative, "Oh, yeah." 10 minutes into the Apple TV Plus comedy, just about everything we need to know about the new head of Continental is apparent. Movies are Matt's world. As we soon discover, he has no significant other, no family, no real social life. His knowledge of cinema, from action franchises and Oscar winners to obscure indies and the international art house, rivals that of any film geek. And for the most part, he has good intentions. When he gets his promotion, he keeps a promise to make his assistant, Chase Suey Wonders Quinn, a creative exec. Yet he's so desperate to succeed in an industry that is now itself desperate to succeed in the face of technological upheaval, labor unrest, audience fragmentation, and a post-pandemic slump in theater attendance, that he is in effect no better than any other spineless suit. Which is precisely how the filmmakers and actors Matt reveres see him. Worse still, he is insecure enough that this constant rejection sends him into a spiral of self-loathing buffoonery that gives the studio, created by Rogan, Evan Goldberg, Peter Hook, Alex Gregory, and Frida Perez, the rhythms of a Curb Your Enthusiasm studio head edition. The studio is a timely, funny, and exuberantly, though not uncritically, cinephilic panorama of a business caught in the latest battle of a war between art and commerce that has raged since studios like Warner Brothers were still run by their namesakes. It's also 2025's best new show to date and one of Hollywood's sharpest self-portraits in ages, which is saying something considering how much the entertainment industry loves to celebrate and satirize itself. Auteurs dabbling in television love to frame their shows as 6 or 10 or 13-hour films, as though there's something inherently superior about the cinematic form. But as proudly as the studio wears its love for movies, specifically the good old-fashioned, non-IP-based ones, it is also unapologetic about being built for TV. Delightfully episodic, it throws Matt, his underlings, and the famous people, who are always guest starring, often as themselves, into a new debacle in each half hour. There's a kinetic L.A. noir riff in which the studio head, donning a trench coat and fedora, takes it upon himself to investigate the disappearance of a reel of the Chinatown ripoff Olivia Wilde is directing. Another episode set at a work gala for the pediatric oncologist, Rebecca Hall, Matt is dating, finds him struggling to convince her physician colleagues that the scatological Johnny Knoxville zombie movie he's working on is just as important as their life-saving profession and features a particularly Curb-esque escalation of his insecure antics. Matt makes a great anti-hero in part because he's the perfect foil for everyone around him. His creative compromises can be devastating to the ambitious Quinn, who has yet to become fully jaded. His sleazy work buddy, Sal, Ike Barinholtz, couldn't care less about art, but is, to Matt's eternal consternation, beloved by the talent because he's fun and chill. The cynical trend-chasing marketing executive, Maya Catherine Hahn, playing refreshingly against type, makes Matt look principled by contrast. Some combination of his guilt and his craving for the approval of a maternal figure drives him to offer a lucrative producing deal to his embittered predecessor and mentor, Patty, Catherine O'Hara. Hilarious as ever, but not on screen as much as you'd hope the second billed cast member would be. Matt may be a selfish, cowardly fool, but his sincere love of film makes it impossible to root against him, especially when the alternative is letting Sal or Maya fill Continental Slate with a whole powdered drink mix cinematic universe. Instead, the barrel-scraping Kool-Aid project, which Matt stupidly tries to reshape into a self-aware Barbie-style masterpiece by buying a Martin Scorsese script about Jonestown's Kool-Aid-drinking suicide cult, is not the only thing the studio has in development. Rogan and his co-creators round out the season with an Indiewood period drama directed by Sarah Polley and starring Greta Lee that Matt cannot stop himself from messing with during an unwanted set visit that puts the entire crew on edge. The executives laugh, cry, and rejoice as they screen a crime drama written and directed by Ron Howard, only to nod off during an incongruous, mind-numbing coda that brings the runtime to nearly 3 hours. The problem is, Howard has final cut, and no one at Continental has the guts to confront him about his terrible ending. The studio knows that the war for the future of movies is worth fighting, even if the generals are weak and the conditions on the ground miserable. I got into all this because, you know, I love movies, but now I have this fear that my job is in ruin to them, Matt confesses to Patty in the premiere. It is true, she concedes, his new job is a meat grinder, and yet, when it all comes together and you make a good movie, it's good forever. That was Time Off by Judy Berman, and it was somewhat abbreviated. Time Off Comedy. Here is an abbreviated portion of the 25 Best Stand-Up Comedy Specials on Netflix by Will DeGravio. Netflix has been producing and distributing original stand-up specials for well over a decade and shows no sign of slowing down. The streaming behemoth released more than 40 original specials in 2024 and is moving at a similar clip this year, premiering half a dozen since January 1. It is a lot to take in, and though there is thankfully no comedy equivalent to the USDA nutritional recommendations, the most fulfilling laughs surely involve some mix of sampling the unfamiliar and revisiting old favorites. Winter drags on and the news overwhelms, which is why it pays to seek out the people who know what in the world is so funny. Okay, it looks like I have 9 of the 25 to read to you. Love to Hate It by Ronnie Cheng. Many know Cheng from The Daily Show, where he's most often seated or standing still. Here he shows off his physical comedy, impersonating baby boomers or recounting a story about embryo freezing. He pairs this stage work with the insightful social commentary that makes him one of the faux news program's standouts. On Drugs, Lucas Brothers. Identical twins, Keith and Kenny Lucas, begin their 2017 special by declaring war on Richard Nixon, who himself declared war on drugs, leading to the disproportionate incarceration of millions of black Americans, including members of their family. Beyond their deadpan commentary, it is a fine example of a duo working in perfect tandem, never missing a beat. Where was I? Trevor Noah. In this 2023 special, the South African transplant provides the ultimate outsider-insider commentary on American life, a man who had lived close enough to see the country for all it is, but retained just enough distance to see that to which so many are blind. Nanette, Hannah Gadsby. Gadsby's 2017 special feels as raw and fresh as ever. The comic masters the tonal shift, going from goofy to deeply serious in their reflections on art. Nanette arrived at the height of Me Too following the first election of Donald Trump, but its themes remain essential. Tambourine, Chris Rock. Much of Rock's 2018 special deals with fairness, from structural racism to the ways parents try to protect their children. But Rock is at his best when he gets personal, talking about his divorce. It is a moving, hilarious work by a master. Comedy, Comisado, Hannibal Buress. In 2014, Buress went viral for a routine about Bill Cosby. He addresses the fallout here 2 years later, along with the fame it brought him. As he proves a wonderful plate spinner, jumping from one topic to the next, there's no subject from which he fails to draw out a laugh. Love you, Adam Sandler. Sandler's singular in part because of his unrelenting sincerity in a time of pessimism. Guitar in hand, he wields his usual tricks to reflect on his life's work. He ends this 2024 special with a moving tribute to comedy, singing his appreciation for comics who have shaped him and us. Paper Tiger, Bill Burr. Burr is one of the most self-reflective comics of his generation. Commenting on his race, gender, and privilege, Paper Tiger 2019 begins with a tirade against political correctness, but then he flips the script, deconstructing his own anger. He remains, through it all, a dude trying to figure it out. 3 in the morning, Sam J. Some comics are so adept at making us feel like we're in a private conversation that it is easy to overlook their careful structure and masterly delivery, such as the case with Jay's 2020 special, focused on her relationship with her girlfriend, but roving from Me Too to Greta Thunberg. To watch it is to see the debut of one of today's greats. Moving now to an issue of Time further back in time, March 10, 2025. Climate. Net zero is not enough. Australian mining billionaire Andrew Forrest's Green Crusade by Justin Warland. Time receives support for climate coverage from the Outrider Foundation. It does not take long at lunch with Andrew Forrest for him to start seeming less like an Australian mining billionaire and more like a climate activist meets zealous prosecutor. Forrest is spelled with two R's, F-O-R-R-E-S-T. His rugged features quickly appear not to reflect the arid expanse of Western Australia's Pilbara region, home to the core operations of his $38 billion Fortescue iron ore business. Rather, they appear the result of a succession of high-stakes court battles. When we meet at a luxurious Paris brasserie, He speaks passionately about a client that he's been representing for several years, the planet. His case, corporate bosses must act now and act fast to tackle climate change, an argument he delivers with force and the unrivaled credibility that comes from decades in the carbon-spewing industry. Then, his soup turning cold, he grabs me by my lapels and rattles off the facts as he sees them. Fossil fuel industry executives are culprits, doing all they can to resist a transition to a cleaner economy. In other heavy industries, bosses have been lazy and short-sighted, focused on quarterly returns while the world burns. It is time for businesses to stop talking about long-term targets, he tells me, and completely ditch fossil fuels in the coming years rather than in the coming decades. If you think you cannot go green, then you are right, he says of his industry colleagues. It is time for you to get off the stage and learn from someone with more talent, more conviction, or initiative than you who can lead your company. Critically, this is not simply talk. At Fortescue, the mining behemoth he founded in 2003, Forrest has begun just such a transformation. He is building renewable energy projects, purchasing a fleet of electric mining trucks, trying to catapult green hydrogen to market. It is about character. It is about leadership, he says. Central to Forrest's pitch is a cutting dismissal of the corporate fixation on quarterly returns. His preferred yardstick is the medium term, a long enough time period to make a meaningful change, but soon enough so that he will actually be around to judge the results. Fortescue's $6 billion green investment, for example, is meant to transform his company into an environmentally friendly powerhouse by 2030. We are taking long-term bets, which accrete value on the way, he says. I make it sound simple, but it actually is pretty simple. And then, just as quickly as he had begun, our lunch still unfinished, he stops himself almost mid-thought. Is this enough to start? With his opening argument delivered and a slap on the back, he's gone in a flash, off to his plane, which was waiting to whisk him to Munich for an engagement with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. That was last February. In the years since, I've watched Forrest take his argument global, traveling with him to Las Vegas, where he announced a $3 billion investment in electric mining trucks, and catching him at conferences in New York and Switzerland, where he cajoled other executives to come aboard his climate quest. The image that emerged is of a rare private sector voice, literate in both climate science and financial markets, and one willing to make the audience the business case for climate to any audience. The biggest challenge for Forrest is not one of technical feasibility. If all goes according to plan, actually decarbonizing Fortescue will be the easy part. To succeed, he must convince investors, employees, perhaps most importantly other CEOs, that going green is worth the risks, financial, reputational, and otherwise. The task could not come at a more important time. A wave of populist sentiment has led political leaders to take a step back on climate action, even as the effects of a warming planet become ever more apparent and grow ever more dire. It is a complex needle to thread. Companies can act on their own, of course, but to do so, they need to be sure they will make money. If he succeeds, Forrest and his project to transform Fortescue, where he serves as chairman, would become more than a forceful case for saving the planet. They would become a powerful case study for generating financial dividends by decarbonizing. Failure, on the other hand, would discourage other business leaders already nervous about the current political climate. The dangerous part about what we are doing is that if we are not successful, the inspiration for thousands of other companies won't be there, he says. And if we lose money on this in the long term, people say, well, that's philanthropy. Forrest's tale begins with a warning. It is not a pretty story. We are sitting at the dining table of his company jet en route to Las Vegas from New York last September, and I've just asked him to recount the story of how he became a climate advocate. Between bites of chicken wings, he rewinds the clock to 2016. He was hiking in a remote part of Australia known as the Kimberley when he fell off a cliff into a gorge. In gory detail, he described how his leg was reversed, stuck, pointing in the opposite direction, when someone pulled him out of the water. He survived, but it would take years to recover. Forced to take a break from his hectic day-to-day CEO life, he decided to pursue a PhD in marine ecology. That opened his eyes to the alarming realities of how climate change is harming the oceans, the acidification that's killing marine ecosystems, and the looming risk that oceans will not continue absorbing carbon at the same rates, meaning faster growth of carbon in the atmosphere. He says that the deeper understanding steered him to do everything we can to stop global warming. It was, in short, a sort of Damascene conversion, transforming a mining industry veteran into a climate campaigner. Since then, it has been a whirlwind. The Minderoo Foundation, founded in 2001 and co-led by Forrest and his wife, from whom he is separated, has come to fund everything from efforts to address lethal humidity to climate migration. And he's committed deeply to the cause of protecting the oceans. While many of his billionaire counterparts buy yachts to party, Forrest bought one and turned it into a research vessel for ocean scientists. M. Sanjayan, CEO of Conservation International, talked to Forrest as he fundraised for a new initiative aimed at protecting 5% of the world's oceans. In their phone conversation, Forrest realized he was soon going to fly over Sanjayan's office in Washington, D.C., so he directed the plane to land. A few hours later, they had dinner near the airport, and Forrest became a top contributor to the $125 million initiative. He is just larger than life, says Sanjayan, reflecting on that first meeting. Forrest's biggest climate initiative, though, is what he's doing with his own company. Under the mantra of Real Zero, a play on the increasingly controversial phrase net zero, Forrest has said his company will ditch fossil fuels in its land-based operations entirely by 2030. To make it happen, in 2022, the company launched a $6.2 billion capital investment plan to decarbonize its primary mining operations in Australia's Pilbara region. That money has funded everything from efficiency to renewable energy generation. When we arrived in Vegas, I saw the unveiling of the effort's crown jewel. Shortly after entering the Las Vegas Convention Center, the exhibition area turned dark. Triumphant music blared as drummers and dancers performed. The curtain dropped to reveal a massive electric mining truck capable of hauling 240 metric tons of material. In Forrest's phrasing, his plane could fit inside the truck's bed. It was not hyperbole. Even at my height of 6 feet 3 inches, I had to look up to see the top of one of the truck's tires. Forrest said Fortescue, which partnered with a Swiss manufacturer called Liebherr to develop the trucks, had already placed an order for 360 vehicles. The deal, valued at nearly $3 billion, sent shockwaves across the industry. It is metamorphic for Fortescue, and it is a turning point for the world mining industry, Forrest tells me. Shareholders are going to say this company's going green and saving us money. The cost savings, switching from diesel fuel to electric mobility, is expected to total in the hundreds of millions of dollars annually. The work has garnered the praise of bigwigs in the climate community. In New York, I watched as Forrest traded compliments with leading climate scientists. In Davos, I sat in as he convened the likes of Al Gore and former U.S. climate envoy John Kerry. This guy's willing to make really big bets, and sometimes they pay off, and probably more often than not, they pay off, says Sanjayan. I'm glad he's making it on something that could be transformative for the planet. This article written by Justin Warland has reporting by Charlie Campbell in Canberra, and it has been abridged. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.